welcome to this Inside Higher Ed podcast. Essayist at large Scott McLemy traveled over the weekend to Stanford University for the Future of Minority Studies Colloquium. The colloquium comes at the end of the FMS Summer Institute. Scott sat down with Satya Mohanty, director of the FMS Summer Institute and professor of English at Cornell University, to speak about the project.
First of all, welcome, Professor Mahanty.
Thank you, Scott.
If someone has not read any of your work in postpositive realism, is unfamiliar with FMS, is there any way, I hate to ask, to explain it very briefly?
I'm one of the founding members of the FMS research project, which is inter-institutional and interdisciplinary and relational. There are undergraduates here, there are graduate students, many faculty, junior faculty, tenured faculty, mm-hmm. and all the way to up to chancellors and presidents of universities. Mm-hmm. But the Summer Institute is something that we started last year. The FMS research project has been around since 2001, mm-hmm. And the Summer Institute was started last year and funded through a grant from the Mellon Foundation, which pays about 60-70% of the expenses, and then the various institutions chip in. And the Summer Institute's goal, basically, is to expand the kind of research and mentoring project to institutions that would normally not be in touch with the original members of the group. Expanding group, but people come in through the Summer Institute, and it's through a fairly rigorous selection process. We had, last year when we had the Summer Institute at Cornell, over 100 people applied. We could only take about 15, and so as you can see, it's not a very hard thing to do to realize there's a huge need out there, a huge social need. Mm-hmm. We can only take a few people. And so the Summer Institute has a two-week summer seminar, which is always taught by two people who've collaborated in the past. And it's on, you know, fairly general topic, usually, with a disciplinary interest. Then there's a summer colloquium, which is the weekend between the 2 weeks, mm-hmm. Where a lot of other people come. And that's what's happening right now, as you said. So you want to know about the theoretical work that we've actually been going on. We've been sort of doing this work since the early 90s. Some of it sort of originated out of collaboration among literary scholars and ethnic studies scholars, mm-hmm. And philosophers of science, ethics, and so on. And the idea was to basically see if the sort of dominant belief in the humanities among many humanists, that notions like objectivity and so on are all passé, are all dangerous ideas. We wanted to see whether that was in fact a valid idea, mm-hmm. that a valid belief. And we think that that's not true. There are notions of objectivity, notions of reasonable and feasible that not only are around but need to be defended. In fact, they're more valuable than the kind of generalized skepticism we mm-hmm. see in the humanities, at least. So the work was produced, at least the initial series of essays and books that came out were produced in the from the early 90s on, 93, 95, through, well, it's still, the last volume just came out, the most recent volume just came out. It's called Identity Politics, Identity Politics Reconsidered, and that's from Palgrave. Mm-hmm. But the volume that actually got this project going was a volume published by the University of California Press called Reclaiming Identity, and that was edited by Paula Moya and Michael Hames-Cassia, who were both untenured scholars at that point. Mm-hmm. So the core idea, I guess, is, again, going against the grain of the dominant strand of thinking about this in the humanities and in some of the social sciences as well, that identities, in fact, do matter. Our social identities are incredibly important, and we need to think seriously about them, and we need to think seriously about when they get in the way of honest, good thinking, we need to know why that happens. And when they enable good, honest thinking, we need to know why that happens as well. So mm-hmm. that's kind of the core idea. So defense of objectivity, of a reconfigured, should we say, kind of a hermeneutical, non-positivist notion of objectivity on the one hand, and a sophisticated account of identity in its many forms. That's sort of the heart of the project. Of course, it opens out into all kinds of other things now. as we begin to have more serious and sustained interaction with social scientists like Claude Steele and Hazel Marcus and Ansi Cantor. So when we get to newer stages of our research, newer stages of collaboration, of course, new topics of research open up. But those were the core ideas that got us started. One place, by the way, where you could, one very short summary of theoretical ideas and so the FMS project is the short introduction that Linda Martin-Alkoff and I co-authored. It's about 8 or 9 pages, and it's the introduction to the Identity Politics Reconsidered volume, the volume that just appeared a few months ago from Palgrave.
That I've not seen yet, but the volume from 2 or 3 years ago that Paul Moya co-edited had a feeling of a manifesto almost. Is that fair to say?
Well, yes. I mean, there is a manifesto, but it's, if you see the manifesto character to it, but if you look at the number of people involved in that, mm-hmm. From junior scholars all the way up to fairly senior, chairs of departments and so on, and from different disciplines, history, literature, philosophy, you'll realize that there was an attempt there to, as often happens in the sciences, you have an alternative a theory, an alternative approach, alternative to the dominant one, and you want to present it as coherently and clearly as possible. The idea being to kind of shake things up a little bit, to get people to consider this alternative, because in fact many of these people believe that this was a better alternative than the dominant set of ideas about identity and objectivity that existed then in the humanities and still exist.
Well, now you mentioned the collaborative element, and that's certainly at the conference, what's striking is that you are seeing panels that you might see at any given disciplinary conference, but you would not see all at the same conference normally. That's not something you see in the humanities very much. Perhaps in other fields you do, other areas. I wonder if that has, if there's a project there for the longer term, what cumulative effect would this have if it continued? To put it another way, what is the future of minority studies? What does it make possible, or are you aiming for, that might exist down the road, X number of years, 10 years, a dozen years, that would not be possible without a sort of deliberate initiative to do that kind of collaborative thing?
Very good question. FMS has two facets, as you know. One is the research project, where even before the institute was inaugurated in last year, 2005, through the help of the Mellon Foundation, we were doing research across institutions and across departments in the humanities. There's some of the humanistic social sciences involved as well. And our primary sort of mode of doing research was through collaboration. We actively tried to have co-authored articles and people sort of exchanging ideas that were not quite ready to be published yet, but certainly interesting enough to be shared and then get feedback from folks. Now, this happens all the time in the natural sciences. If you didn't do this in the natural sciences or some of the social sciences, mm-hmm. you simply couldn't do research. But for some odd reason in the humanities, we are taught, from the first day when you're, a senior or going to graduate school, first-year grad student, that you've got to be your, the lone star, you've got to hang on to your ideas, don't share them, and so on. I've encountered this all the time in teaching, and of course, then when you start interacting with folks from other disciplines, you realize that this is just counterproductive. So part of what we did was partly because of who we were. We used to talk about ideas before we were ready to publish them, and part of it is because we thought it was a conscious, deliberate, there was a real need to introduce this as an alternative way of thinking and operating, doing research in the humanities. So since 2001, we've been doing this. The response that we get from people, scholars and project, and start noticing that what you just noticed, and also this is not just about the conference, this is also about the way things get written and think about our ideas and communicate, is astonishment. They said, this is so much fun. It's so, it's so good to be able to work like this. And that's one thing that they simply are not prepared for. They're surprised by it, and pleasantly surprised by it. The second thing is they realize the work actually deepens. It's the basic kind of, Stuart Mill would point this out, right? The more relevant points of view that you can sort of get to sort of enter into a discussion, the more our research deepens, and often junior scholars recognize that. But we're fighting against the dominant culture, which in the humanities, which emphasizes a kind of narrow individualism, isolationism. And I think we've broken that barrier in a number of ways. But I think it's more important to emphasize that it's not just the idea of collaboration with the folks in the same hallway as you, in the same department. That's difficult enough. But it's, you know, somebody in Ithaca, New York, writing something, writing a piece with somebody in Eugene, Oregon, or in Palo Alto, California, or in Arbor, Michigan, communicating via the email, but also iChat, video chat, things like that. That opens up all sorts of new possibilities. I mean, write a paragraph, sometimes you have half an idea. So it's sort of like, you know, the old coffee house idea. We got go explore ideas over a cup of coffee, and we're doing that now even when we're not sitting face-to-face and talking with other people. And we really fully understand certain kinds of shareware, software, has really been very, you know, not everybody uses it. I think it's becoming more and more common in the FMS, which is a very large group, about 30, 40 people now, you know, people, over, say, 40 to 50 campuses in the country. So one more thing. It's not just inter-institutional. It's breaking, and this is the thing I'm proudest of, sort of color lines that divide institutions. So it's one thing for folks at Michigan, the University of Michigan, and Cornell, and Princeton, and Stanford to communicate. That is, I mean, yes, they cross some boundaries, but that's sort of, that happens. But for people at mainstream institutions or elite institutions to be collaborating with, not just sitting in the same room, but collaborating with, scholars in the same field who are at sort of poorer institutions that don't have the resources, and poor institutions that you know, sort of HBCUs and small state universities and community colleges. We've broken that color line, and that's the thing that I'm proudest of at this moment. I mean, if you look at the S. Mellon Fellows who came in last year or who are this year at Stanford, you'll realize they're from all very, very smart. They're the best of the lot, but we had to try very hard out that this is not just about a bunch of people at Stanford talking to a bunch of people, Michigan and Syracuse and Cornell. It's just elite institutions, and I think we've succeeded in that. And I'm hoping that in a few years' time, that'll in fact be the norm, not just for us, but our model becomes something that other people can follow. You know, I sit in search committee, graduate admissions committee meetings, and so on, and realize that things don't quite work, and people say, well, why don't people apply? You know, and so, right kind of effort. You have to build relationships actively, you know, before people will apply and take it seriously. And I think that's started to do it. We're doing it. But I think our model is one that other institutions can follow. One final thing on that note, and this is, I'm quoting somebody now, Jeanette Gold, the president of Bennett Comer Spellman, was doing a workshop for us at Cornell last year for our FMS Summer Institute 2005. And she said something which has stayed with me. She said, you know, I want to tell you why FMS is succeeding where so many other initiatives like this have not succeeded. And that is because are not separating the mentoring aspect from the research and collaboration aspect. You're putting the two together. So there's a bunch of folks doing research, actively engaged in research, sleeves rolled up and so on. And then somebody who wants to find out about that, a junior scholar or some, you know, graduate student or faculty, just joins that group and learns naturally. She said, well, you know, think about how, in say the old days, how somebody learned to carpenter. You didn't go to a class on carpentry. You hung out with carpenters. You apprenticed. And that's still the best way of learning, very dewy and kind of simple, right, ideas. So collaboration, learn by doing, and this sort of horizontal mentoring process where it's not just one mentor and one mentee, so it's community where you have individuals you can work with in that way, but you also have peer mentoring and this idea of an ongoing project with some common topics. Now, the topics in some sense aren't limited. Values are clear. We are our values. We are hierarchical, not just non-hierarchical, but anti-hierarchical. And we are collaboration and not narrow individuals. Something that good scientists and good researchers have always done. It's just that we humanists have been resistant to it for some reason, or just maybe ignorant.
Continuing now with the second part of the Inside Higher Ed podcast from the Future of Minority Studies Colloquium at Stanford University, we're talking now with Paul Omoya, an associate professor of English at Stanford and one of the organizers of this weekend's event. Professor Omoya, I'm curious about a couple of specifically higher ed aspects of the FMS project, and maybe they're related. There's a strong emphasis here on dealing with the power differences between various groups, but I wonder how you've dealt with one of the really big ones in the academic world itself, namely the situation of adjuncts. And the other thing is, I wonder if you talk about the emphasis here on providing mentoring for young minority scholars and faculty.
Because a lot of the people that we are involved with mentoring or involved with, you know, ourselves as members of FMS are in sometimes precarious positions within the academy as a result of our minoritized identities, as a result of our gender or our race or our sexuality or sometimes all three of those or more. The first impulse was not to try to change the structure or to attack the structure as much as to find ways of surviving and then thriving within the structure. So a lot of our efforts to date have really focused on what are some of the strategies we can use to help people survive within those structures. So a lot of it has involved, like in some cases, there was one young woman who was adjuncting. She was a postdoc, and I think she was a fellow last year, and she's been involved in FMS for a few years. And partly through interaction with us, she has now transitioned to a tenure-track position. So that's been where our focus has been, is to try to get people into tenure-track positions, because as difficult as it is to be a junior faculty, you have more security if you are able to make it through that. Plus, you have more power within the academy to make change. So, the Summer Institute, which is a relatively new thing within FMS, about 6 years, the second year of the Summer Institute, was designed in large part to serve as a mentoring body. And the people that we have admitted into the Summer Institute have been, for the most part, junior faculty or graduate students, sometimes advanced. But, you know, graduate students had a relatively good chance of going on to faculty positions. Have let in a couple of postdocs who have since gotten tenure-track jobs. And, in fact, one of the people we admitted this time had been adjuncting, and we accepted her. And the time of her arrival, she did succeed. And so a lot of our focus then will be on helping her survive within that tenure track position, hopes that she will get tenure around and available to mentor other students. So I think that's kind of the way that a mentoring function that we're very cognizant about and very self-conscious about intersects with your question about hierarchy in the university. So we're looking at where that is and how it is that we can stay within those pathways, hopes of making some change. I think until we have some sense that we have any kind of real security, it would be hard for us to then put our attention to changing.
Something I'm really struck by at this conference, as someone who goes to a lot of conferences, is the lack of anxiety and abjection that I'm used to seeing in the humanities when you have people who are the designated, recognized theorists, and then the people who are not that, but who are using their ideas. There is very little of the kind of performance of mimicry, of stargazing, and it's no need to name any names, but anyone who's been to MLA has seen this in action, say.
Oh, absolutely. And I think that we have very self-consciously tried to create spaces where that kind of thing wouldn't take. And a lot of the reason that it works is because the people who are involved who have reputations that would allow them to be stars have a sort of ethical approach to scholarship and a commitment to FMS as an organization that they don't behave that way.
Right.
And so because they don't behave that way, that encourages, you know, say graduate students or even undergraduates to interact with them as people and to interact with them on the basis of ideas and not on the basis of like, oh, you're hot and I want to like be in your aura. I mean, it is striking to me that people such as Leslie Feinberg, who are quite famous and I'm sure can command all that sort of adulation at conference or whatever, that she comes and, sits in the audience for the entire time. Now, when it's her time to say something, she gets up and she responds to people with as much respect if they're a graduate student as if they're, a senior faculty member or the provost of, mm-hmm. Spelman,
right.
That her response to everybody is predicated on her response to what they're saying or their idea. Same thing, I think, with Linda Alcoff. Linda Alcoff from the very beginning, her ethic of very much on the basis, striking to me, Angela Davis, who by any stretch of the imagination it's very clear that a lot of people here at this conference, when they see her, have the little heart fluttering.
Right.
She came and she's here for the entire 2 days. She doesn't go away at lunchtime. She sits down, she talks to people, and so it's partly the way that they behave that allows for people who might have less status, at this point in the academy, to really try. And we do this as a self-conscious practice because we think that, and we talk about it, that when I say self-conscious, when call up to invite somebody, we'll tell them, this is the kind of, we want you to come, we want you to be here, and, we don't want you to run off,
Right.
And we also don't pay high honorariums. And one of the effects of that is that if they come, they're coming to be involved in the project in a real way, not coming to get a high honor. So I think that has a lot to do with the lack of the objection that you see.
Right.
And frankly, the reason that I'm so committed to this is because we don't have that. And it's that's not to say there isn't disagreement, as you saw in this last panel.
Right.
Which is fine. I mean, disagreement is fine. And but shaming for the sake of, making oneself feel better is not acceptable.
Well, those things are maybe relatively easy to want to do.
Yes.
And yet to actually see that is the spirit of things and the way that people's demeanor show that they are with the program on that.
Yes.
Is remarkable.
It is remarkable. I'm not quite sure how exactly we've managed to do it, other than maybe because we started small and have built by adding people little by little by little, and that the people who tend to want to come back are the people who want to participate in that kind of
stuff. I hope you'll write something to explain how it's done and that this
will become... Well, I guess I'm going to have to think about that seriously. I probably do have ideas about how that's done. I think by stating it, by talking to people about what it... I think that's one of the ways it's done. We work hard not to leave implicit kinds of practices we're involved in, explicit. The other way I think we've done it is by changing formats. This was the first time we did a keynote speech. All the 6 years that we've been, did one with Nancy Cantor, partly because we've heard her give so many talks, and we just thought, okay, this time, because she's chancellor so smart about these ideas, that it was worth highlighting. But it's also noteworthy that she came in and she stayed all day, stayed for lunch, she stayed for part of dinner, she interacted with various people at various levels, and jet in and jet
right,
out.
Right, parachuting in,
yes.
That's if you're lucky.
Yes, and in fact, somebody who is a social psychologist who knows Nancy said to me, it's amazing Nancy came today, even at one of their professional conferences where she was barred, she came in and accepted the ward and went to one other talk and left. It's something about the expectations that we have set up. Another example of that is that, and this was funny, I wanted to laugh at this, is we came yesterday and at 9 o'clock everybody was sitting down. The conference was supposed to start at 9. We had 100 people sitting in the audience waiting for us to start. How often does that happen?
Not very often.
It was just amazing to me, and I was laughing, and I said to one of my friends, I said, my goodness, look how well socialized all these FMS people are. But there is a sense that, okay, there's a high bar here, and we're going to step up to, we're part of something bigger than ourselves, something good.